ReportSD.net.
Seated. Thank you. Good morning. The first case set this morning is case number 30736 in the matter of discipline of Tucker Valesky. On behalf of Mr. Valesky, Michael Tobin is present representing him. Mr. Valesky is present in the courtroom. And Thomas Freeberg is here on behalf of the South Dakota Bar Board of Discipline. We've got about 40 minutes scheduled. What I'd like to do is maybe hear from the lawyers, each of the lawyers of record, about 10 minutes. And then Mr. Valesky, hear from you. The court may have questions for you. I don't know. The lawyers want to go first, maybe. Hear from Mr. Freeberg and then Mr. Tobin. We'll put 10 minutes on, and then we'll hear from Mr. Valesky after that. So go ahead, Mr. Freeberg.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel, Mr. Valesky. As this court's well aware, that it's been very clear throughout that the purposes of discipline in this state is not to punish the lawyer. Frankly, if that were the primary objective of discipline, I think you would have seen a much different recommendation from the disciplinary board. Some of the conduct and the filings by Mr. Valesky were very problematic to the board, but when they looked at their requirement to protect the public from further fraudulent, unethical, or incompetent activities, to preserve the image and integrity of the attorneys, the bar, and the legal profession as a whole, and to deter like conduct by other attorneys, they ultimately reached their recommendation of a 30-day suspension. In reaching its recommendation, there's some facts I want to point out that the board found particularly problematic. First and foremost, of course, is initiating a lawsuit naming the South Dakota Supreme Court as one of the entities who is being sued. Frankly, the board found this to be unbelievable. They couldn't believe that an attorney was doing that. Based upon when they reviewed it, the very clear Rooker-Feldman holding, judicial immunity, that Mr. Valesky showed a lack of sound judgment in making that filing in the first place. Judge Lang in the district court action held a hearing on a motion to dismiss and on Mr. Healy's request for injunctive relief. The injunctive relief was denied. The case was not dismissed initially when there was a hearing in November of 2023. But in denying that, Judge Lang, in denying the injunctive relief, Judge Lang found that there was limited likelihood of success on the merits and that it was highly dubious. I think it's important to also note that Judge Lang spent a great deal of time going through this with Mr. Valesky. I think it's pretty clear from the record that that was probably an attempt to try and steer him in the correct way. After Judge Lang dismissed the injunction, indicating there was limited likelihood of success, Mr. Valesky then, after the case was dismissed, filed a motion to reconsider and to allow the filing of a second amended complaint. It was that second amended complaint where Mr. Valesky made an allegation, and I think it was 12 times within that document, that the justices, the individual justices of this court, had fabricated evidence in reaching their decision in Healy 1. Frankly, the board had never seen any such allegation. They were very concerned that there, again, a lack of judgment on the part of Mr. Valesky, all in an attempt to try and get the Healy 1 ruling overturned, is frankly what was going on with this from the onset. Rather than just take defeat, Mr. Valesky doubled down, as Judge Smith said, and kept pursuing it and made these outlandish allegations. Ultimately, the case was dismissed, and as has been the case in many of the Healy decisions, attorney's fees were awarded as sanctions due to the nature of the proceedings. Then we have the action before Judge Smith. Judge Smith took it upon himself to file an order to show cause. Again, a very, I think, unusual action by the court, and the order to show cause is why personal sanctions should not be imposed against Mr. Valesky, and sanctions imposed against Mr. Healy under Rule 11. Judge Smith, in reaching his decision, which is Exhibit 14, went to great lengths to lay out the history of the Healy litigations, which are numerous in this state. So again, Mr. Valesky had two judges, some of the best lawyers in the state, consistently demonstrating to him that he was missing the mark, yet he marched on. Is that arrogance on his part or a lack of understanding? We don't know. But again, he continued when it was clear that there was not a basis for doing so in law or in fact. In fact, the only time that Mr. Valesky backed off in these actions was when a complaint was brought to him before the disciplinary board. He hired counsel to represent him before the disciplinary board, and then he made the correct decision just to get out of all further representation of Mr. Healy. Throughout these proceedings, Mr. Valesky has denied that he violated any of the rules of professional conduct. That continued through the hearing before the disciplinary board. It continued through the referee's hearing before Judge Fifley. Again, Mr. Valesky feels that everybody involved in these cases has been wrong except he and his client. At some point, zealous advocacy goes too far, and the board clearly believed that Mr. Valesky had gone too far in making these filings. Clearly, the court felt that Mr. Valesky had gone too far when it imposed sanctions against him in the amount of $10,000. Also concerning to the board in the scope of these matters was that Mr. Valesky confirmed with his client in writing that his client would be responsible for any sanctions that might be imposed against Mr. Valesky. Now, if that isn't a signal to someone that they're going out of bounds and making a decision that is against the law and facts of a case, when he's asking his client to reimburse him for any sanctions that might be imposed, clearly he should have had an understanding that what was happening was improper and a violation of the rules of professional conduct. Judge Fifley and the board both found that Mr. Valesky had violated several rules of professional conduct. Rule 3.1 in bringing a proceeding that was frivolous and that there was no basis in law or fact. And I think that Judge Lang's decision again showed that although Brett Healy's, when he quoted that although Brett Healy's counsel at the hearing provided the zealous representation, the arguments made about why Rooker-Feldman or judicial immunity did not apply and how res judicata does not bar the state law claims were not warranted by existing law or a good faith, non-frivolous argument for some modification or extension of the existing law. The history of litigation combined with the absence of merit of the claims justify an award of attorney's fees to those that asked on that case before Judge Lang. The board also found that Rule 1.1 was violated, that Mr. Valesky had not exercised good judgment and done proper research and attained the necessary legal knowledge and skill and thoroughly prepared before filing the claims that he did, both in state and federal court. Also, 8.2a, that the lawyer shall not make a statement the lawyer knows to be false or with reckless disregard as to its truth, or falsity concerning the qualifications or integrity of a judge. When he's making allegations that this body fabricated evidence, concocted evidence to rule against his client, he certainly was in violation of Rule 8.2. I want to just briefly touch upon the trust account. That was one of the issues that the board also had with Mr. Valesky. He indicated that he didn't know how to operate his trust account, so he was just taking approximately $1,000 a month when he was paying his sales tax. While he kept records of whose money was in the trust account, he was clearly commingling his funds with earned fees from clients with client trust funds.
So, Mr. Freeberg, how did the board first become aware of that? Was that something the board asked Mr. Valesky to provide trust account records? Did it come up in the hearing, or how did that happen?
The board did ask to subpoena the trust account records to the hearing. He cooperated. He provided very detailed and accurate records. It just showed a lack of understanding of how the trust account needed to work.
So you had all of those records before the hearing?
Yes.
And then, as I understand it, after the hearing, there was some follow-up?
Yes, and Mr. Valesky then took the action to move funds out of the trust account that were for fees that had been earned. He had just had a habit of keeping them in there, which we believe resulted in sales tax and income tax not being accurately reported, because he didn't count them as income or receipts until they were pulled from the trust account into his operating account.
So the board was able to verify that, at least at the last check, that Mr. Valesky was in compliance with the trust account?
Yes. When he had made those changes before the hearing, before Judge Feifley, he had gone through and made gotten that cleaned up. So, and he did have very good records. We're not critical of the record keeping. It's just the manner in which he kept those records that was
so. My other question is, which is a little different than the violations you're talking about. When it comes to recommended punishment, the board recommended 30 days. Was there any kind of cases or anything you looked at to make that determination or to make a recommendation of 30 days? How did the board come up with that?
You know, the board wavered from anywhere from disbarment recommendation to ended up landing on the 30-day suspension. I think after the Franchu case that had been before this board, where Mr. Franchu had clearly and openly violated a number of court orders and trial cases, was looked at by the board. In Lance Russell's case back some time ago, the court had indicated that youth and a lack of experience was a mitigating factor when determining the appropriate discipline. Mr. Valesky, I think the board felt, lacked from not having a mentor or proper guidance in how he was conducting his practice, and felt that he hopefully would learn from the experiences. I'm not certain that's the case after going through the referee's hearing, but that was the board felt that there was that those things were in his favor. Judge Smith, even in his complaint that he filed with the board, indicated that Mr. Valesky does well in front of him in his court. He indicated that he's welcome to return to his court at any time, but he was clearly fed up with the continuation of the Healy matters.
So, and that was my last question for you, and the court may have other questions, but other than his representation of Mr. Healy, and we've got the trust account. Let's set that aside for a moment. But aside from the trust account or from the claims involving Mr. Healy, the allegations there, did the board come run across or find any other instances where Mr. Valesky had made similar baseless or frivolous claims in court for any other client?
No, we didn't have any indications of that. There have been no prior complaints against Mr. Valesky for that type of conduct.
Mr. Freeburg, one of the ways that we formulate our factors to consider in matters of attorney discipline is deterrence, and you mentioned it earlier. We tend to say deter others. We don't often describe that in terms of deterring the lawyer who's the subject of the disciplinary action, but perhaps that's a consideration, and that's one sort of question if you have a comment on it. The second one is, did the board consider or are you aware of any other instances or any other cases where a lawyer has steadfastly remained fixed on this idea that they did nothing wrong? And how does that figure into perhaps deterrence, other cases involving attorney discipline, things of those nature? Usually, and they're not common, but usually we don't have that.
No, and one of the things that the board lives by, and I guess even recommends, is when people are appearing before them, they need to be candid. I don't think there was a question about Mr. Valesky's candidness. They need to be concise and, when necessary, contrite. And That lack of contrition on his part was deeply concerning for the board. I don't, in my experience, I don't recall any cases that the lawyer just simply felt they had done nothing wrong. Exception maybe was In re Light. Mr. Light had trust account issues and held steadfast in his belief that he had not violated the rules when he had kind of let others control his trust account.
So, with reference to the potential sanctions available, there's been some form of a recommendation, perhaps, regarding a probationary-type period. What conditions of probation, based on your involvement with this case, would you find to be helpful?
I think, as Judge Feifley found, a mentor of some sort, someone to, and maybe, you know, other than standard-type cases, if Mr. Valesky is going to get involved in something that may be more controversial or out of the norm, that he have someone review those with him to make sure that he's filing things appropriately or things that are appropriate. You know, he's been in practice, I believe, 6 or 7 years now. But having a mentor and someone to bounce things off would be important. He could provide regular reporting of his trust account to make sure that he continues to remain in compliance with the trust account. You know, we didn't feel there were any issues with regard to substance abuse or those types of things. You know, if mental health issues, which are often accompany these types of behaviors. The board didn't believe any of those existed. So those types of follow-up may not be necessary or required.
Any other questions for Mr. Freeburg? Okay.
Thank you.
Tobin?
May it please the court, counsel. On behalf of Tucker Valesky, we appreciate the opportunity to be before you today to have this hearing and have this disciplinary matter brought to a conclusion one way or the other. Mr. Valesky has maintained throughout that he did not violate any of the rules. And I understand that there's a concern about candidness and candor and contrition. And I would respectfully submit to you that someone can learn, someone can change just by going through this process without necessarily having to say I did something wrong. Tucker Valesky never imagined he would ever be here. He doesn't want to be here, not in a disrespectful way to you, not in anything like that. But when he started his representation of Mr. Healy, the idea that he would be before this court on a disciplinary hearing was just not imaginable to him. And I think it's...
I was just going to say, Mr. Tobin, you saw me pause. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to break your stream of thought, but as long as I have. You know, I understand your argument. I think that the idea of accepting responsibility is can be viewed maybe as something even broader than just the general principle of accepting responsibility and going through that process. It seems like it also could serve as a basis for any tribunal to assess the likelihood that the conduct will reoccur. The idea that somebody says, you know, look, I get it, shouldn't have done that, and ready to move on, communicates in a clear way, in addition to on general principles, accepting responsibility, but that communicates and begins the process by which a tribunal could say, okay, well, we can assess that. And we can have some degree of assurance that, you know, this isn't probably going to happen again. When that's not present, it makes that much more difficult.
And I think that's fair, Your Honor. I certainly recognize that. I think that this court can take some consolation in that this is the only matter with which I'm aware that Mr. Valesky has ever had a disciplinary hearing. In other words, but for his representation of Mr. Healy, I don't believe Tucker Valesky would be before you. There is no history of him filing other lawsuits that are scandalous or unfounded or anything like that. It's truly in the representation of one individual. So I think when you have 5-6 years of experience under his belt and then before this court can, I think, take some solace in knowing that there's something about this Mr. Healy and the representation of him in that matter that spun this in a direction that leads us here today.
I don't think he agrees that it's unfounded.
He does not believe that he violated the rules. That is correct. And I think what is important, Your Honor, is to go back in time. Because right now we're looking backwards from 2025, looking back at everything that's happened. And if you go back in time and look at it from not the beginning of the Healy litigation, that predates Tucker even going to law school. But when Tucker began his representation of Mr. Healy, it was really an attempt to answer a question that this court said it was not going to answer in the Healy 1 decision, and that is, who owns this ranch? And everything that's been done since then has really been a arm wrestling match between Mr. Healy and his family for that. So the first representation was the RICO case. The RICO case was dismissed, and the Eighth Circuit affirmed that. But there were no sanctions. There were no D-Board recommendations. But it was a very novel, very unique effort to try to think of a legal mechanism. How can we try to get this ownership issue in front of a judge to make a decision on that issue? Because this court foreclosed a whole variety of different avenues on statute of limitations grounds in both Healy 1 and Healy 2. So if you look at it from the beginning, that was essentially Tucker's homework. How can we get that issue appropriate before a judge for determination? He went with RICO. He worked with experienced lawyers from Chicago and Washington, D.C. in that particular matter. Now, it was unsuccessful. There's no question about that. And then he continued to think of, how can I find a vehicle, a way to get that issue before a court? Now, one of the ways he came up with were constitutional deprivations based upon the court's handling of the Healy 1 decision. And that's one of the main reasons why we are here today. But it was to try to vindicate a right that this particularly difficult, litigious man, Brett Healy, was trying to vindicate. That's what Tucker was trying to do. Now, it was not successful. Judge Lang, to his extreme credit, I think was very patient. He was very thorough with Tucker and the handling of that case. But I think it's important to note that Judge Lang indicated that the representation was quite zealous. The briefing was extensive on all those issues, and that's all in the record before you. This is not an individual who just willy-nilly and blindly went forward, not worried about issues of judicial immunity, not worried about issues of the Rooker-Feldman doctrine. He was trying to constantly stay a step ahead of the motions to dismiss.
Well, in some way, that's an aggravating factor, because he's intentionally maligning the judiciary to avoid a potential judicial immunity defense. And he has explained that in the proceedings before the board and the referee in some detail now.
Correct. Between Mr. Valesky and Mr. Healy, they believe that there were some issues with the Healy 1 decision. That's all in the record. There's no question about that. And what I think Mr. Valesky did that I would be critical of is that he pled it in ways that walked him into why we're here today. That second amended complaint is long enough, but had he maybe gone into greater detail to talk about the use of emails, to talk about the use of financial statements, and why it may not have been, from their perspective, from a pleading perspective, necessarily accurate, that might be a different thing. I think it would feel different, and I think the effect would have been different. But yes, to come in and say that evidence was manufactured, sure, that's a troublesome verb. There's no question about that. But again, the reason he's doing that is to try to plead around various affirmative defenses. Now,
as I understand it, in the proceedings before the board or the referee and or maybe, Mr. Valesky acknowledged there was no factual basis to suggest the court had created or falsified evidence.
And that's
101 pleading rule. You cannot, and the rules of professional responsibility prohibit you from making a claim that is not supported by law or fact. He acknowledges it was not supported by fact or law. Why is that not a violation of the rules?
Your Honor, I respectfully would suggest that it was an attempt by Mr. Valesky to avoid an affirmative defense. And I've already conceded, and I will concede again, that the use of the word manufacture, that's what's problematic. And I think that's where this lesson can be learned, and I know Mr. Valesky has learned it, that before you are going to launch such allegations...
But how can we be confident that he's learned that lesson if he stands up and tells us, I didn't do anything wrong?
I think in two respects. One, as I've already mentioned, is that other than his representation of Mr. Healy, he has not had any other problematic pleadings that I am aware of or that this court is aware of. The rest of his practice has been as normal and routine as we would all hope it would be. There's not any other issue or concern. Even someone like Judge Smith, who sanctioned him and was quite critical of him, was otherwise quite complimentary of Mr. Valesky in his letter to the disciplinary board. So I think that's one avenue. I think the other one is in reference to the trust account. When it was brought to Mr. Valesky's attention that he may be doing something wrong there, innocently, and there was no intent by Mr. Valesky's part, he immediately changed. And he changed immediately, and by the time we had the referee hearing, everything had been done and changed in a way to the satisfaction, I think, of everyone. So I think that is another thing that the court can take some consolation in, that when he is shown that maybe there's a better way to do something, he will do that. And I think that somewhat speaks to the need of a mentor that I think Tucker would welcome. He's already applied for one. There's been some communication issues in getting one implemented, but that is something that he would welcome.
So when you say that Mr. Valesky has learned this lesson, learned from it, and perhaps we'll hear from him in this regard, but I really want to make sure that I understand what you're saying, because the way the record indicates, when that question and that line of inquiry is presented, it seems like the thing that he learned was that he, if he had it to do over again, would say, upon information and belief, the judge has manufactured evidence and willfully tried to injure Brett Healy. I don't know if that's a fundamental difference, and I want to know, is that what you're referring to when you say he's learned his lesson, or he's learned from this and would not do this again? Or
no, I think what he has learned, unquestionably, is that if he is going to take on a piece of civil litigation that is objectively going to be something that could end up in the newspaper, for lack of a better example, I have every confidence that Mr. Valesky now will reach out to someone, whether it's a formal mentor or someone else. I think that he has learned the valuable lesson of having a second pair of eyes and a second legal brain review the allegations, the pleadings, and to make sure that he is not going to be making the same mistakes that he made here to that led him to be in front of you today.
So there's also been a finding that he has a fundamental inability to understand res judicata, collateral estoppel, and claim preclusion. How can the court be assured that that lesson has been learned? Because that's a matter of protecting the public when you have a paying client who's willing to pay any sum to advance their claim.
And I think the answer there is I think Mr. Valesky understands those concepts very, very well. He was tasked with trying to plead through them and around them. And his research and his rationale is all in the briefs. I mean, it's not that he missed it or didn't understand it. He was just trying to craft arguments that Judge Lang did not accept, but he was trying to set forth and craft arguments as to why they may not apply in this particular case. I think he understands them perfectly. He was just in this instance trying to plead through them. But all the rationale is there. I don't think that there is a concern that Mr. Valesky doesn't understand what they are.
That does almost make it worse, doesn't it?
Well, you know, we have cited some, in our proposed findings and conclusions, we have cited some ethic opinions, I believe from North Carolina and Oregon, that make it clear, at least in those jurisdictions, that it's not per se frivolous to file a pleading, even though there may be an applicable affirmative defense that applies. And I think that's part of what we are talking about, is that there are instances where a lawyer may file a pleading where there could be a clear affirmative defense that applies. But it's then going to be up to the defendant to then raise that affirmative defense. I don't know if it necessarily is per se frivolous, because probably the most common affirmative defense that is applied and probably regular is going to be a statute of limitations. And if every single time a lawyer files a document that's now kicked on a statute of limitations, I think that would be strange. I don't think that's necessarily what this court wants the message to be from today.
And I get that. I completely understand that. The first time. But then you have the second time, and then you have the third time, and maybe the fourth time. I'm not sure. But that's what's concerning to me is, you know, separating out the falsification claim. If you have a statute of limitations defense, you lose in court. You say, okay, I'm going home. You know, that's unfortunate. I wish we could have won that, but we didn't. And if you appeal it up to this court and we affirm, it's all over. So what do you do with that second and third time or fourth time or whatever it was?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And I could certainly sit here and think of a variety of instances where it may be valid. I mean, there might be something that is discovered after the fact. There might be something that was not included in an original complaint. For example, if it's a medical malpractice case, maybe a lawyer or someone did maybe recognize there was some continuing treatment. So there could be valid good faith arguments for a reconsideration of that or for a second or third attempt. But I think that's all in the merits of what is being refiled with the court. So I didn't interpret your comment as a per se prohibition against trying again, but I think it's going to get into what is the basis for, in my head, a motion for reconsideration. There's going to have to be something different. There's going to have to be something that wasn't presented the first time. And I would agree with you in that regard, Your Honor. I know my time is out, but if I could just very briefly address some mitigating factors, because I do believe if the court is going to find violations, it's well accepted that this court will consider a variety of mitigating factors. And one of them is going to obviously be Tucker's relative inexperience. At the time these things were all occurring, he had been out for roughly 3 or 4 years. I think that is a mitigating factor. I think that he being a solo practitioner and only being out for those number of years, I think that is, again, another mitigating factor. I also believe that there are a mitigating factor that this court will consider are other sanctions and consequences. And obviously one of the sanctions that Tucker has is he's got this $10,000 sanction from Judge Smith that will be paid. So that's an additional factor that I think this court should consider.
Actually, it hasn't been paid, though.
It hasn't been paid as of yet, and it will be. He's not appealing that, and I don't know the status of that appeal or where it is at. I believe it's before this court in some
capacity. He says he doesn't want to prejudice the appeal, but legally I'm unclear on that. When you don't appeal something, you just don't appeal it, and the trial court order becomes final unless you appeal it. So that's a final order, unappealed from. The Supreme Court, there is no holding. There's no nothing. When something is not appealed, right, wrong, or indifferent in terms of the result in the trial court, it just is final. And so that's final.
Yeah, we're not taking a different position, and this court can certainly disagree. I think it was just not paid out of an abundance of caution not to do anything that could prejudice his former client in whatever he is seeking before this court. I don't get the sense. I obviously, you know, I've never spoken to Judge Smith about that, nor would I, but he's appeared before Judge Smith numerous times since that sanction order has been entered, and I'm unaware of any particular proceedings or issues with Judge Smith. But I can assure this court it will be paid. It was just not paid out of an abundance of caution.
So remorse is a mitigating factor. Is that present here?
I think there is remorse. He doesn't want to be here. He has... I don't know if shame is the right word. Something Mr. Valesky and I have in common is that our fathers are attorneys. Our older brothers are attorneys. And when you come from an attorney family, to then be an attorney yourself it means a bit more. And I can only say that as a person who I have that in my own life. And I think that Mr. Valesky is shameful that he has to be here. He absolutely, he will apologize to you in his remarks because he doesn't want to be here. He doesn't believe he did something wrong, but he can still be remorseful for the process and he can still learn from it. And I know that he has and he will. My last two concluding remarks, very, very briefly. Mr. Freeburg referenced both the White case and the Russell case. I'm glad that he did. I was prepared to talk about those. I find the facts of those particular cases to be far more egregious than what is here, and the recommended punishment in those particular proceedings were public censures. And I would just urge the court to consider the facts and the allegations that were in those cases with what is here, and as you weigh, if you find any sort of violations, as you weigh any sort of punishment. So with that, Your Honors, I thank you, and I conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Tobin. Mr. Valesky, we'll put a little time, we'll put 10 minutes up there, and I want to give you the time you need to tell us what you want to tell us.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, Honorable Justices, first, I'm very sorry that we are here today. As Mr. Tobin stated, I never wanted to be before you in a disciplinary proceeding. Nevertheless, I stand before you with the utmost respect for this court and the disciplinary process, recognizing the gravity of these proceedings and the responsibility I bear as an officer of the court to uphold the highest standards of professionalism and integrity. Going on 6 years of practice, I recognize that each day requires renewed commitment to the principles that govern our profession and to serve my clients and the administration of justice with diligence, honesty, and respect. Other than with my representation of Mr. Healy, I have not had any other disciplinary complaints filed against me. My law practice has been and remains good and positive, as I have represented numerous clients without incident or issue, from wealthy individuals, businesses, governmental entities, to the most vulnerable and least fortunate among us, who are left with nowhere else to turn. Admittedly, with Mr. Healy, my focus necessarily became centered on creative or novel ways to vindicate his rights as to ownership issues related to his family's ranch. That approach required attempts to maneuver around certain defenses and procedural bars, trying to state legally viable claims. In doing so, I attempted to plead claims against this court and its members based on specific aspects of a prior decision, claims principally grounded in due process, which I believed, based on diligent research, could be stated with legal plausibility and give Mr. Healy a chance to vindicate his rights. I acknowledge that these efforts were not successful, and I accept accountability for what occurred. I also recognize the disciplinary concerns which arose, leading to where we are today. I'm sorry. I understand the profound trust placed in me by this court, my clients, and the public. I take this responsibility seriously and have always sought to act in a manner consistent with the values of fairness, candor, and accountability. I am proud to be an attorney and a member of the bar. It is truly humbling to be before you. This is not what I ever thought would happen, but I can certainly say that I have learned from this experience with a reinforced commitment to maintaining the integrity of the legal profession and to ensuring that my actions reflect the honor and dignity of this noble calling. I also understand the importance of the faith that is placed in the judiciary, as I have also been entrusted with that great honor and privilege serving as a tribal court judge for a full 4-year term. Realizing judges are humans too, nobody is perfect. That experience has given me a perspective, appreciation, and empathy for the role and the importance of confidence in the judiciary, which all of you humbly serve. I'm respectfully asking this court to conclude that no rules were violated. I am genuinely sorry we must ask you that, And I can earnestly say that I never want to have to ask you that ever again. I have full confidence in this court's ability to evaluate the facts and circumstances of this matter fairly and impartially. I am grateful for the opportunity to address these accusations and reaffirm my commitment to the ethical practice of law. Thank you for your time and consideration.
So, Mr. Valesky, if I'm right, you first began representing Mr. Healy in January of 2021?
Sounds correct, yes.
So not quite 2 years into practice. Is that right?
That's correct.
So from that time, January 2021 to today, both in the litigation that you commenced and in the disciplinary proceedings, tell me what you've learned.
Caution, more than anything. Caution, and when you get into making bold claims of the nature that I made, which really call on others who are more experienced, and I like to think that I did my diligence, I did my research, I can state claims, I can pursue them. But having more experience on board certainly be advisable in those situations. And with the RICO case, I had experienced attorneys working with me to begin with. Towards the end, I was the only one on the pleadings. So that would be my response, Your Honor. Looking to the experience of attorneys who you can call upon for guidance and counsel in these situations.
So at that time, January 2021 and even beyond, I know your father's in practice and a brother in practice. You practiced solo, correct?
Correct.
Did you have anybody you considered a mentor at that point in terms of, hey, I got a question on this case. I'm, not sure exactly what the theories are or how I should who did you go to in those instances? Or did you have anybody like that?
Howard Foster was an attorney from Chicago. He helped on the RICO case. We did stay in contact. He was certainly the most experienced in terms of these issues. He wasn't deeply involved in the cases at that point when these matters arose. But he was one. Of course, Mr. Healy had other attorneys working for him. I would correspond with them from time to time. But ultimately, I was bringing these cases as a solo practitioner on my own.
Other questions for Mr. Valesky?
If we, let's just say there's another case for you out there in the future and it doesn't go your way and the fortunes of litigation don't go the way of your client, which happens to the best lawyers out there. Looking at everything that we have in front of us, and we've read everything, what assurance is there that we can glean from this record that if your client is adamant enough, you won't let your zeal get ahead of meeting your obligations under the rules? How do we know that? If you have an adverse result the next time and your client says, I don't care who the judge is, let's sue the judge. What do we have in front of us that says, that won't happen again?
That's what I would be committed to doing. Obviously, when I bring a case, I'm looking to do good for my client, do my best, and ultimately you want to win. But somebody's got to lose. Somebody loses.
But what's here? What gives us that comfort? And I appreciate your remarks. I'm not saying that. I'm not discounting them, saying they're nothing. What else is there? Is there anything else? And maybe that's fine. Maybe your remarks say, hey, you just got to take my word for it. Okay, that's a response. But let's say you have an adverse result, and you know, you think very, very much that the judge got it wrong. Your client thinks very, very much that the judge got it wrong. But you've exhausted whatever options you are to have or to seek review. What is there in here that convinces us that if that comes up again, you're just not going to, you know, assail the institution?
You appeal, you lose your claims, you're out. That's generally the end of it. I was still pursuing Mr. Healy's claims here. I did withdraw at a certain point. I extricated myself from the litigation. The courts allowed me to withdraw. And other than this, these matters of litigation on behalf of Mr. Healy, there's never been another like scenario like this.
So the answer to my question is there's nothing in the record other than the fact that these allegations stand alone against the rest of your background and experience. That's the answer to the question, what we can take from the record as far as an assurance. Just that it's not, it's more isolated, an aberration as it relates to the rest of your experiences.
And I acknowledge how it turned out, what happened here. I never want to be in this position again.
So one of the things I give you credit for, and it cuts both ways, you were a real advocate for Mr. Healy. You know, a lot of lawyers, I shouldn't say a lot, but some lawyers get in trouble because they don't pursue claims they should pursue. They procrastinate. They're not vigorous in representing their client. They sit on rights of clients. That's how some lawyers get in trouble. You didn't appear to have that issue at all, particularly in this case. You were an advocate for your client. I also appreciate the fact that you've never thrown Mr. Healy under the bus. You've, to many respects, although you don't necessarily concede you violated the rules, many respects you say, this is on me. I made the decisions. I was driving the bus. It's easy in these instances for a person to throw someone under the bus, and Mr. Healy might be an easier one to throw under the bus. But in any event, I say all that. My concern is where you tell us we don't, you know, I didn't violate the rules. You know, let me just give you a scenario. Let's say, and I don't know if you do tax, but let's say your client comes in and says, I had $1 million in income this year. I want you to make up $950,000 in deductions on my tax return. Put those in. They're not legitimate. They're false. But I want you to file that income tax return for me. I assume you would agree with me that if you did that, you'd be violating both the law and you'd be violating the rules of professional responsibility. Agreed?
Correct.
So how does this scenario differ from, I guess what I'm trying to ask you is, where's the line? At what point in time is a violation of the rules, and I acknowledge that you don't think you violated the rules, but at what point in time is that line crossed for the lawyer? Is it okay if the lawyer just says, well, I didn't violate the rules, so I'm okay? I don't know, do you understand my question?
Well, I think you got to look at the lawyer is saying he didn't violate the rules. I think your example with client coming in, having you falsify documents to submit to the federal government, that's a clear-cut case. You can't do that. You can't help your clients perpetuate a fraud or commit a crime. in this instance, talking about pleadings, specific and complex issues, a number of them, and attempting to state plausible claims.
But you harm in that process of being an advocate and crossing the line, in my view, in my perspective, crossing that line, you harmed your client. I mean, he incurred how many tens of thousands of dollars of attorney's fees that are already there. And, of course, I know he's got the appeal on this sanction. But even prior to that, he'd been sanctioned. In your zealous advocacy, you effectively harmed your client. Would you agree?
Yes, Your Honor. He got sanctioned for $240,000. I filed it. I made the motion to dismiss. That ultimately comes back on me.
Any other questions for Mr. Valesky?
So, you know, in thinking through that whole process, you know, you can cloak it under information and belief or legal plausibility, but at the end of the day, in order to find a workaround, a judicial immunity argument, you allege that the court manufactured evidence 10 times, and I didn't count them in the second amended complaint. And so, to me, that smacks of a win at any cost attitude. And you know, in trying to sort through this and untangle what happened in the thinking process, you know, can that be the motive on behalf of a lawyer, on behalf of his client? I'm going to step over the rules. I'm going to win at any cost. I'm going to try to win at any cost. I mean, there has to be, and there are, very strict ethical rules that govern all of this, as you well know.
Yes, Your Honor. Lawyer has to have awareness. It's not a win-at-any-cost game. It's upholding integrity, doing your diligence, and trying to do right by your client, protecting his rights, and being fair to the administration of justice as well. I acknowledge I did assert in Claim 5 of the second amended complaint, which I asked Judge Lang to allow me to file, a claim involving fabrication based on previous aspects of a specific previous decision based on specific aspects of it. Judge Lang didn't agree with me that it should be filed, and he denied my ability to do it. And at that point, we were looking to proceed on the case, and I thought to give my client the best chance to vindicate his rights, the claim should be asserted.
And have you changed your view on whether or not that was a proper way to proceed?
It wasn't. This was dismissed. There were sanctions that were issued. And I understand the Eighth Circuit upheld that decision.
Any other questions for Mr. Valesky? One last thing, Mr. Valesky, I'd ask you. I think Mr. Tobin referenced you'd reached out to a mentor. Do you have a particular person in mind?
I was not at this point. I'm open to any recommendations who the bar would assign to me.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Valesky. That will conclude this proceeding. The court will take it under advisement. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. Thank you, Mr. Valesky.